My name is Gene, and I too am an alcoholic.
Hi, Gene.
Some years ago, when I was relatively new to this program, I was experiencing a lot of difficulty in accepting the basic concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess I was no different than many young people who came to AA and still come to AA, for I was only 24 years old. And I wasn't quite sure, you know, that I wanted this way of life. As I said at some of the previous meetings here, I approached Alcoholics Anonymous as though it was some sort of a punishment or a penance, you know, and I was getting the wrong end of the stick for all of the drinking I had done. And so with that kind of an attitude, I found this program rather difficult, and I sat at many meetings, you know, full of that bitter denial, looking for the loopholes, looking for the reasons to get out. And I found a lot of them because I stayed drunk for the first 6 years that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I managed to put periods of sobriety together, about 30 days, 90 days, and then I'd get elected secretary and I'd go out and get drunk, or I'd become this or that, you know. And I just never could seem to put it together. I realized later on in my sobriety what I'd been doing wrong, because I had been looking at all of the things that had been told me and taught me. I had been looking at them through the wrong eyes, and I certainly had the wrong conception about what the hell they meant. You see, I believe some of them idiots that run around in Alcoholics Anonymous who say that this program is free. And that was attractive to me right off the bat, because being an alcoholic, I'm a taker, you know, and anything that's free was very alluring to me. But you and I know now that this program is not free. And I used to wonder when the group would get up and recite the Serenity Prayer what the hell they was talking about, because they'd say right off the bat, they start a meeting. You know, you come into a meeting, it takes a lot of courage to come in here. You come walking in here because you think you got a booze problem, and all they're talking about in the beginning of the meeting is something called serenity. It says, God grant me the serenity. I thought I was in the wrong place, because I didn't come in here looking for serenity. I came in here looking to do something about my drinking problem, because I was convinced that if I could handle my drinking problem, I'd get all of the serenity I wanted, if I wanted it. I'm still not too sure to this day. And I say, hey, I say this in total honesty. I don't think I want serenity. Really, the way I interpret serenity. Serenity to me, you know, sort of looks like an LSD trip. You know, you're up there rolling along on a couple of clouds, you know, smelling daisies and things like that. And no worry. Jesus, I'm not alone in this, am I, huh? I thought nobody understood me. So, it was very confusing, serenity. See, I think all of us have some misconception about serenity. If serenity means just to lay back and take it easy and not be involved, I don't want anything like that. You know, I want to have a reason every day of my life. I think the worst thing that can happen to anybody is to take purpose out of their life. You know, if you ever reach that stagnant stage of not knowing why the hell you're getting up, you know, that must be a horrible feeling. And I have talked, you know, I have talked with a lot of, they even got a word for them now, and I don't think they like it very much. Geriatric alcoholics, for Christ's sake. That's another kind of a scam, I guess, some outfit's putting over, because they have designed programs for geriatric alcoholics and whatever. I guess that's supposed to be old people in AA. Well, I've worked with people, you know, who are up there in years, and I don't call anybody old, you know. And I've heard a lot of these people make a statement like that, that the biggest fear that they have in life is not having a reason for being. And I have that fear now, you know, and I've always had that fear. When I say I want a challenge, you know, I want to have a reason to get my teeth into something, you know, during the day, so that at the end of the day I can Win or lose, you know, I can have some feeling of accomplishment. That at least there was a reason for me being there that day. I don't want to take on all of the world's problems, don't get me wrong, or anything like that. I just want some little problems to handle, you know, like picking up litter and things like that, you know. I just don't want serenity, you know. I want to know I've been there. You know, I have a friend down in Southern. A lot of you know Clancy. You know, Clancy and I have been very close for years, and he sent me a thing years ago that sort of describes what I'm trying to tell you now. I was having a little tough time. Well, I'll tell you the whole truth, what it was. It was when we went to the International Convention in Denver. So this would be almost 10 years ago. I had put in a group of people together, not me, somebody else did. We were all going to go in one plane, you know, try to save a couple of bucks. And the rumor mills get started, or, you know, and all the people, oh, God damn, Duffy's trying to run AA and all this bullshit. And it upset me, believe it or not. For a little bit, I got immature, and I let this upset me, you know. And one of the days that I was upset, Clancy happened to call me up. He called me up a couple times a week, you know, and we shoot the bull, and I said, son of a bitch, and I started to tell him about this. And he says, hell, don't let that worry. He says, I'm going to put something in the mail for you today. And so he did. And there's three people in my life that I have admired tremendously, and I've taken time to sort of read their autobiographies and study their lives. And those three are the late Teddy Roosevelt, the Rough Rider, the former football great coach Vince Lombardi, and the blind lady Helen Keller. These three people, you know, have meant a lot to me in my life because they were the kind of people that I would like to have been like. Or if I could ever mold myself into their character, I'd have a strong feeling of accomplishment. Lombardi and Roosevelt were balls guys, you know. They didn't take a back seat to nobody. And I always remember, I knew Vince Lombardi, and I heard him talk a lot, and especially when he was up around Green Bay and living there in De Pere, Wisconsin. This kid was going to St. Norbert's. And Vince was the kind of a guy that said, you know, he didn't buy that line of crap that says, it doesn't make any difference whether you win or lose. It's how you play the game. Vince would say, bullshit, you know. He said, show me a guy that believes in that and I'll show you a born loser, you know. And that was true. And so here I was down because I was getting criticized, you know, for trying to do something nice, I thought. And then comes this thing from Clancy. And it was a quote from Teddy Roosevelt. Now, I can't quote it exactly, although I look at it about every day because it's hanging on the wall up there. But it goes something like this, you know. And this is Teddy Roosevelt speaking right after he had received terrible criticism about the establishment of our national park systems. I guess most of you are aware that it was Teddy Roosevelt who done that, see. And he got a lot of criticism for that because he was a big game hunter and people were trying to think that he was making governmental-only hunting preserves for him and all that kind of sick crap that comes out of rumors. So he was sort of down. And he went before Congress or the House or whatever it was, and he was explaining his intent, you know, and how he felt. And he said something like this. He said, the whole world, you know, is like a great big arena. And he says, sitting around on the outside of the arena are a whole lot of people. And he says, then down in the middle of the arena, where the battle is going on, are the fighters. He says, they're down there getting covered with blood, mud, sweat, and dirt, and most of the time they lose. But winning and losing don't mean too much to the people down in the arena. What they're grateful for is that they don't have to number themselves amongst them sons of bitches who sit around on the outside doing nothing, you know. And that's how I felt about serenity, you know. So I want to be part of, you know, I'm referred to as a fanatical AA, you know. Well, hell, if that's what fanatical AA is, AA is my life, you know. And Jesus, why not be fanatic about living, you know. So serenity was a strange thing when I came here, you know. And free, this is free. What are you talking about? I got to go to Lent's and all of that. So I had this serenity prayer all mixed up. Actually, if I could have written the Serenity Prayer, it would have been something like, God give me, because it was free, God give me sobriety, because that's what I came here for. Had nothing to do with serenity. And I guess there were times I'd even mumble that. I'd say, God give me sobriety, you know. And I meant it. And it never happened. Somebody said, you just got to have a desire. Let me tell you about some of the days I had a desire. You should have seen the day I was going into the penitentiary. I had one hell of a desire. One hell of a desire. There are a lot of times I had desires to do something, but I never did do anything about the desire. You have to put the desire into action. We all know that. There's a whole book, whole chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous explaining into action. And I sat on a lot of bar stools waiting for my desires to be filled, you know. And I'd get drunker and drunker and drunker, you know. And it just never happened. And then I have never been able to recall whether I thought this up, which is highly improbable, or I heard this. I just haven't been able to ever pinpoint the source of this bit of knowledge that I have, you know. Somewhere along the line, all of a sudden, it dawned. God grant. And it doesn't say God give. Now, right off the bat, I always figured grant and give, what the hell is the difference? They're both the same. They don't, you know, it means to give somebody something. And basically, that's probably true. But, oh, is there a world of difference in those two words? And it's important that you be aware of those differences. Because the awareness of those differences explain what our program's all about. Now, most of you who are native to California should have no trouble understanding the word grant, because this entire state was settled under the grant system. For you see, to give somebody something is to hand over unconditionally, as you would at Christmas time, or a birthday gift, or a wedding gift. No strings attached, an expression of goodness. That's what you do when you give. Now, when you grant, you give somebody something under conditions. This is only yours to keep if you adhere to and follow certain conditions. It's just like the grants that are given to major universities, you know. Exxon will give Stanford, you know, $5 million for the exploration of offshore oil leases in Qatari. And that's what they mean, in Qatari. They don't mean down in Santa Barbara or up off of Seattle. They say, you're going to be able to keep this money if you explore what we tell you to explore. Those are the conditions. So then I began to understand AA, why I was having so much trouble with it. Because I began to, and I'm no student of history, but I began to, in the area that I live in, I began to poke around and investigate what the full meaning really is of grant. Now, I live in the Napa Valley, the wine country, you know, a little town called St. Helena, you know, and where I work is in Calistoga. Very beautiful, picturesque, sort of a Tom Sawyer-type place, you know. And it's part of Napa County. Now, Napa County at one time was part of a larger parcel of land, which now encompasses the counties of Solano, Sonoma, Mendocino, Humboldt, and Marin. Now, that was one huge parcel of land in the early development of California. Now, the man who was sent to that area to develop that land was a general by the name of Vallejo, who headquartered in the little town of Sonoma. That's where Vallejo's headquarters were. Now, I don't know what the hell Vallejo's first name was. Howard, we'll call him. Howard Vallejo. Now, it was Howard's job to develop all of this land. Now, the purpose for developing the land was so that everybody in this area could benefit by each other's efforts. So Howard took a couple of guys and he made a big tour all over the land. You know, he drove up to Eureka and down around Fort Bragg and Petaluma and Marin and back over through Suisun, Fairfield, Vacaville, and Vallejo and Napa and up into the valley and to see what was around and to see what he had, what he had to work with. Then he went back over to Petaluma, where he had his adobe hut over there, and he mapped it all out. He made a plan that would work using all of that land, a plan that would allow everybody to subsist and exist if the plan was followed. Because he knew what could grow here, what could grow there, what they could get from here, and what they could get from there. Then when he took his master plan, he put it down, and he cut it up into sections. And he was going to delegate certain guys to take care of each section. And he was going to grant them the land to do this. And they could keep the land if they followed his directions. So he got a whole bunch of them together, and I wasn't there. I don't know how it was. But it might very well have been something like this. He might have said, Charlie, I'm going to grant you about 5,000 acres over there in the Napa Valley. Now, we don't know too much about the Napa Valley. I want you to put in maybe 10 acres in oranges. And we'll just see how them oranges grow. Because, you know, we can all use oranges for our orange juice in the morning, our screwdrivers a little later on. And then he said there'd be some black folks moving up into the valley. Gonna have some watermelon. Gonna have some watermelon for the black folk. And he says, then, you know, I want you to put in about 100 acres in corn. Now, that might sound like a lot of corn, but I'll tell you what I want you to do with it. You see, I've got another guy taking care of some land over there in Petaluma. And he's going to raise a hell of a lot of chickens over there in Petaluma. Now, you ain't got any chickens, but you got a lot of corn. So you take some of the corn over to Petaluma, and them guys in Petaluma will give you some chickens to take back. That's why I want 100 acres in that. And he says, hell, Ma's apple pie, let's put in about 100 acres in apples. You know, make a little cider, a little apple pie, and things like that. And that'll help us out a lot. And then, you know, for the bread bakers, we're going to have a little wheat, whole wheat bread. And we can trade that wheat, because we're going to have a lot of it, with them guys up in Eureka. Because them guys up in Eureka got a lot of crabs, but they've got no bread. So they'll give you some of their crabs for some of the wheat. And then you can take some of the crabs and give them to the guys in Petaluma, and they'll give you some of the eggs. This way we're all going to make it together. And hell, we've got to have some tomatoes for Shaky. When Shaky comes along, open up the pizza business, we're going to have a lot of tomatoes for Shaky. And then, you know, we've got to have some lemons for them hot lemonades, you know, them cold lemonades and lemon meringue pies and all of those things. And boy, does this land look good for grapes. We're going to put in a lot of grapes because later on the world is going to go ape shit over grape jelly. And that's just about how he had it. And so Howard says to Charlie, he says, Charlie, you see what I got up there? Charlie says, I got it, Howard. And he says, well, if you do it like that, Charlie, you can keep the land, but if you go screwing around and put in more tomatoes than I told you to put in, or you knock off the melons and put in something else, forget it. Out. I'm going to take it all back. The only way you get to keep this is if you adhere to the conditions. Charlie, are you sure you're willing to go to these lengths? Does that sound familiar? And Charlie will say, yeah, Howard, but are you sure it will work? And Howard says, well, Charlie, rarely have we seen a person fail. We're certainly following our path. So Charlie says, I'll take a crack at it. Well, I guess you get the general idea of what the hell I'm talking about here. Trying to make it a little humorous, but you know what it is in AA. It's the same thing. Only we got to turn them over, you know? There are things called acceptance. Got to have some acceptance or this thing don't work. Do you know what you're talking about when you're talking about acceptance? Do you realize what you have to accept? Now, I guess if we went right down these lines here and each of you were to introduce yourself, most of you who are alcoholic would say, my name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's fine. That's fine. But do you realize what you have said? Well, if you don't realize what you said or you're having some mystery about this, read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Because a lot of people don't know what the hell an alcoholic is. I wouldn't want to embarrass anybody in this particular group here tonight or any other group for that matter. But fact is fact, and I've never been known to slack off from anybody. If we were to hand out pencils and paper here right now and ask you to write down the definition of the word alcoholic, it would amaze you how many different definitions would come back up here at this podium. Whereas, if by your identification you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous you have taken the time to read the book Alcoholics Anonymous and have gotten as far as the third chapter of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, whereas and in it says this, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. Do you accept that? Do you really accept that? Now's the time you separate the cream from the milk. Because this is where it's at. Or are you, well, I'm not sure I'm that bad. Or not all the time. Not all the time. Do you believe, as most of us believe, that having lost the ability to control your drinking, it is gone? It's like a woman's virginity. Once it is gone, it is gone. But like some women, there are some members of AA who try to make you think they still got it. But if they had the capacity to be honest with themselves, they know they ain't got it. And that's what you have to accept. That this thing I have lost is gone. It is gone. Never again will I ever regain that control. Thousands will die trying to disprove that statement. Thousands will die. Perhaps someone in this room will die trying to disprove that statement. But it's gone. And if you can accept that, then you're on your way. You're on your way. How about this? My pet. 57 musts. Holy Christ. If you want to see me boil, come some time when I'm sitting in on one of them intellectual meetings, you know. All them intellectuals gather. Beyond AA. And I'm quite sure, hey, this is not hell for any particular sector. It happens in San Jose. Happens in Chicago. Happens in New York. It happens all over, even in Cotati. There are assholes running around in AA yet. Just because you get sober don't give you any brains, you know. There are some who are dumber now than they were when they were drinking. And they say very dumb things. And the dummies in AA usually expose themselves because they say these dumb things. And years ago, before I was going to say what I'm about to say, I would pre-apologize. I would apologize if I was going to offend any of you in this room. You're number one. Because if I offend you, it's done with love. Have you ever heard anybody in San Jose or at any meeting in San Jose say one of them stupid things like, there are no musts on this program? Oh, Jesus. I'd like to come out of a chair with a spear when I hear that. I still hear that around, you know, and I hear some very respected members of Alcoholics Anonymous make that statement. Let me tell you a little, well, I was going to say funny. It wasn't so funny, although prior to his dying, we became very close friends over this. Some years ago, a lot of you know that I participate, you know, in a lot of AA activities in other parts of the country. You know, I had an invitation, and it's nice. And usually these people who invite you to speak someplace pay your expenses, you know, your plane fare there and your hotel if you have to stay overnight. So sometimes groups like in the Middle West will combine and ask you to speak two different nights, you know, and then they sort of split the expense. And that's all I do. Now, this had happened to me one time, and one was in Milwaukee on a Friday night, and then Saturday night I was to speak at the anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous for the state of Indiana, Hollywood, in Indianapolis. So the deal was set up that I would talk in Milwaukee on Friday night, and then on Saturday morning a young lad was going to drive me from Milwaukee to Indianapolis, which isn't really that far, and he was there, and we drove down to Indianapolis. And as we're driving down, he was telling me, you know, he's in a program about 8 months now, and he's telling about his sponsor. He's in love with his sponsor and all of that, and how brilliant his sponsor was. And unfortunately, he said, the reason I like my sponsor is because he told me that there are no musts on this program. And I began to pucker, you know. And it began to build up inside of me, you know, and I didn't say nothing to this kid. Why you disrupt him, you know? But that night, at this, they had a huge banquet-type deal, and then you have the meeting and you speak. And I talked for about 1 hour and 10 minutes, like a Baptist minister, on the 57 times in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says, must. Man, I was pounding tables and screaming and hollering. And I'm not egotistical, believe me, and I'm not that self-centered, but I wouldn't care who the hell talked. Or anytime you talk, somebody claps. It might be your wife, but that's all right. But that night, Jesus, a death-like silence came over the goddamn place when I got finished. Now, sometimes you wonder, well, did I say something that might have offended somebody? Or did I use a four-letter word or something like that? And I really couldn't think of anything, so I just sat there. And while the master of ceremonies was doing something, another talking, I said to the chairman who was sitting alongside of me, I said, I'm sorry. I said, I don't know what the hell I did or what I said, but I guess we laid an egg. He said, oh, Jesus Christ, no. He said, you got more goddamn guts than any guy I've ever met in AA. I said, why? What the hell is that? Well, he says, to talk about what you talked about tonight, especially after last night. And I said, last night? I said, I wasn't here last night. He says, oh. He says, last night the oldest member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the state of Indiana spoke for almost 2 hours. You know what his topic was? There are no musts. That guy's name was Freddie Abreu. He's since passed away, and at that time he had about 30 years of sobriety. And I met Freddie Sunday morning in the cafeteria, and not to apologize, and I told him how I felt. And then Freddie said something that proves how careful we have to be when we talk, any of us. He said, well, shit, Duff, you know what I meant. I said, I know what you meant. But all of that new people out there don't know what the hell you meant. So don't be running around putting out that cheap bullshit, you know. And so he believed me. And believe me, there are 57 times in the book Alcoholics Anonymous where the word must is used. And that's M-U-S-T. Not you had better, or if you choose, or when you're ready, or any of that other crap. It says you must. You must. I'll give you one of them right off the bat. It says sponsorship is an experience you must not miss, you know. Now, if anybody here has any trouble believing that, if you just contact me where I work, I'll send you a sheet of paper that lists the page number and the first four or five words in the sentence and its location in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, where the word must is used. So, I get incensed when I hear people saying things like that, that aren't part of our program, because there are things you must do. You must do if you want what we have. This is not a free program in any sense of the word. There are things that you've got to be willing to do to hold on to this precious gift. And if you're not willing to do them, then for Christ's sake, go on out there and do some goddamn drinking until you're ready to do them. Because that's the way the game is played. Now, some people, you know, say, oh, Jesus Christ. And then I pull back. I say, oh, yeah, Jesus, maybe I got a little excited, you know. Because, as I told you in a previous meeting here, I have read the dictionary. I study words, you know. And must is a word that I studied. And you can go home and check this out tonight. There are many words in the English language that have multiple definitions. You know, you can look it up and hell's got 15 different meanings, you know. And must is one of them. There are three basic definitions to the word must. One, of course, is the most common that we know, the demand. Demand, as we always know, must. The other one I really should have known living in the wine country. Or any of you who are involved in the making of wine, yeah, sure, there's a guy nodding. Must is how you describe the juice of the unfermented grape. The first crush of the grapes, there's a girl nodding her head there, is called the must of the grape. Christ, they do that up where I live, you know, gallons and gallons of it every fall, and I never knew that. But the third one, Jesus, that really rocked me. Must is also how you describe the male elephant when it's in sexual heat. It's in a state of must. Now let me tell you something. I have been here for one hell of a long time. And I have practiced open-mindedness to the best I can. And there's no way that my mind could ever be that open. That you could convince me that 47 years ago when these guys were writing this book, they were the least bit interested in the sexual problems of elephants. Or the first crush of the grapes, you know. When they put that word must in there, they put it in there for a reason. If you want what I have. And then how about that wheat? How about sponsor? What the hell is a sponsor? What is AA? Basically, what is Alcoholics Anonymous? One drunk talking to another. Sponsorship is the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Probably the second most important thing in our program. No one can deny the fact that the acceptance of a power greater than ourselves has to be, and is told to us in the fifth chapter, is the most important part of our program. No human power could relieve our alcoholism. God could and would if he was sought. Nobody's going to argue with that. But how about sponsor? In the old green and white pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship, it defines sponsorship this way. It said, sponsorship is the heart of the AA approach to recovery. Heart. What's the most vital organ in the human body? The heart. Without the heart, it dies. And these men and women who wrote this literature said sponsorship is the heart. Without sponsorship, we die. Without one alcoholic working with another alcoholic, there is no AA. It's no. But people say, oh, hell, I don't want to bother anybody. You hear that all the time. See, I don't want to call him out late at night. Oh, he's too busy. Hey, read on further. Sponsorship is a two-edged blade that many times it is more important for the old-timer than it is for the newcomer. The old-timer needs the newcomer just as much as the newcomer needs the old-timer. So there is no bother. You know what I heard a guy say at a meeting the other night? I almost hit him with a chair. Right? You hear these nutty guys. He's been getting a lot of good sleep here the last year. He said, I got a new habit, you know. And I'm thinking he's telling me he took Secanol or something, you know. I said, what are you doing now? Because he was complaining about a similar problem we have, you know. And he says, what used to bother me, he says, was the phone would ring. And once I got woke up, I could never go back to sleep. I said, well, how'd you overcome that? He says, I take the phone off of the hook. I said, really? I said, what'd you do, quit sponsoring guys? He said, oh, no, I sponsor about 11. I said, what is it, Pony Express when they want to talk to you? That's true. Guy asked me, he says, what really is a sponsor? How do you describe a sponsor? Well, we could go into all that rhetoric that we know, but where I work, you know, we have around us a lot of seafaring people, a lot of longshoremen, a lot of merchant seamen who find where I work necessary to come to once in a while. And I love the sea. I'm a Scorpio. We're water people, you know. And I have always loved the sea and the water. Ever since I'm born on the Atlantic coast, and here I'm living, you know, right on the Pacific coast. And I don't really know why I never went in the Navy. I went in the Marines instead, but that's sort of watery too, in a way, you know. But I've always been fascinated by the sea. And I love coming across the Golden Gate Bridge, and I love seeing the ships sailing around. And when the big carriers come in to Alameda, I'm always down there. You know, you think I knew somebody on there or something. I don't know nobody. I just love to see it. We drive back home tonight, we go to Carquinez Bridge, and you see the tankers unloading there. You know, it's nice. I like that. And I'm glad I do, because I realized once that's how I could explain sponsorship to some of these guys that I see where I work. Because they understood this, you know. You know what marvels, when I get marveled out about men of the sea? Jesus, the brains these guys must have. Especially them ship captains. You know, you start to realize what the hell them guys do. They're loading up ships right now over in the Philippine Islands or up the Yalu River, up in around Tsingtao, China or some goddamn place. 10,000 miles from here. That's coming to Oakland. In a couple of days, some guy's going to pull out of a harbor over there, say, in Olangapu. And he's going to come to Oakland. And he ain't got any Standard Oil road map or anything like that. Got no big signs when he goes past Hawaii, you know, next three exits, Honolulu. None of that, no. Just gets out there all by himself, you know, and shoot a few of them stars and look around like that. Comes all the way over here, 10,000 miles, to Oakland. God damn it. But something strange happens. Out around about the Farallon Islands, this guy that has brought this ship 10,000 miles by himself throttles down. Sort of slows the ship down. And out from under the bridge, coming out from San Francisco Bay, is a little launch. Chugs up alongside of this huge ocean-going vessel. Ladder's thrown over the side. Some civilian-looking guy hops out, goes up the ladder, goes right up to the bridge, shows some kind of identification. And the captain, this guy who has taken this ship 10,000 miles, turns complete charge of the ship over to this asshole who just got out. And it's this guy's responsibility to bring that ship into the harbor the last mile or so. Now, why the hell don't the captain do that? If he can take it 10,000 miles, what the hell's the matter he can't take it the last mile? Most of you know who I'm talking about right now. Talking about the pilot. Harbor pilot. Conditions of harbors change hourly. Overnight they change. Underwater things show up. Sand shifts. Piers burn down. Hazards arise that it is impossible for all the captains of the world to keep track of. But harbor pilots know what's going on in that harbor every minute. So when they come on out, they know how to bring that ship in. They know if they should go starboard of Angel Island or go to the port. Whether they should be clear of Alcatraz or should they go to Pier 37 or 35. Which one burnt down last night, 43 or 81? They know exactly where to go because they have been there. And then they bring that ship right into that harbor. Ship doesn't get harmed, don't run aground, nobody from the Enterprise in there, you know. And that's really what a sponsor is. That's what that sponsor, in essence, is to us. He's been in the harbor, he's been in here. He knows where to take us. He knows what we should watch out for. He knows where the water runs shallow and the sand is deep. He knows where everything is that we should stay away from, and perhaps everything is that we should be aware of. So sponsorship is a necessary part of this grant. Oh, of course, then the other things are the 12 steps. Huh. What steps? I always get a kick out of it. I don't know if I said it here the other night or not, but, you know, it is amazing how difficult some people make the steps. Especially alcoholics, you know. And it's understandable because they are in direct contrast to how we want to live. We know that. You know, look at them things, they scare the hell out of you, you know. Valley, I mean, turn my life over to it. But Jesus, we have taken most of those steps before we even got here. Was it last week here or some other meeting that I said this, you know? You know, people say, I have so much difficulty, and I think it was here last week, with the fourth step. Hell, you took the fourth step before you ever come to AA. You took the fourth step in order to get to AA. Because that was that time you looked it over and you didn't like what you saw. But hell, 1, 2, and 3, you took them too. Usually when you were throwing up. God help me, God help me. I'm going out of my mind. I'll do anything. God help me. Bang. And he did. Step 1, 2, and 3 right then and there. Yeah. Nothing really difficult about them steps. Unless you want to make them difficult. I heard a guy say at a meeting today something nice. He said, you make any day what you want it to be. Boy, that's true. And it's just like them steps. I could make the steps look difficult right now. If I wanted to, you'd read them backwards, you know, and that's it. And most alcoholics do things like that, you know. We never do things the way we should do them, you know. How about the book? I bet you I'm not the only person in here that when you bought your book, went right to the back. Went to the back to read them stories. That's what I wanted to read. I wanted to read about them loose women. You know? And I read them 16 or so stories. Oh, Jesus, they were horrible. By the time I got finished reading them, I figured, what the hell am I doing in here? I'm not like these people. So because I wasn't like these people, I didn't bother to read the front of the book. Now, because I didn't read the front of the book, in a matter of time, I became like them people in the back of the book. And when I became like them people in the back of the book, I had to read the front of the book. How simple it would have been if I had just read the front of the book. You know. But we can't do that. We can't do that. No. Christ, no. Cross the street. Did you ever see an alcoholic cross the street? Only guy that makes four corners. Everybody else goes right across here.
ought to have 12 traditions.
Oh, yeah, we got to have them. Nobody likes the traditions. They don't like to talk about the traditions, you know? Ever stop to think what the traditions really are? Without them, we'd die. Without them, we'd all be stars. We'd all be heroes. We'd have, let's see, there's 1 million of us now in AA. If we didn't have them traditions, you know what we'd have? We'd have 1 million groups. Each of us would have his own group. And we'd be in there listening to our own bullshit. The exact thing that got us all here in the first place, you know. That's the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our late co-founder Bill Wilson said if there was anything that he could list as the most important contribution on his part to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the traditions of our program, you know. That's some powerful things to be saying. A group of men and women who share their experience, their strengths, and their hopes with each other. We in the group have accomplished what men of science could not do, what men of religion could not do. The greatest scholarly brains in the world were unable to do what you and I did as a group of men and women sharing our own intimate experiences with each other. Both good and bad. Both good and bad. It tells us that in the foreword to the very first edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It says that we of Alcoholics Anonymous are now more than 1 million who have seemingly recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. And to show other alcoholics, if they choose, precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of our program. And then the kicker comes in. They said, we are quite sure that the personal accounts of our own experiences, both good and bad, might perhaps be an integral part of your acceptance to the truth and to the wisdom of this program. The sharing of these experiences. Let there never be any doubt in any of our minds. And in all humility, all we have to offer each other is only our own experiences. There's no one in here knowledgeable about alcoholism. None of us here is qualified for theory. None of us here has a degree in abstinence. All we have is one alcoholic's experience being shared with another. And then we have the closest thing to the guarantee, a God. A power greater than yourself, who most of us, not all of us, most of us choose to call God. And who is this power? Who is this God? Why is this God necessary in this kind of a program? You were told that when the young man read the fifth chapter here tonight. We were up getting coffee. Maybe you didn't hear it. Do you recall the three pertinent facts read at the closing of that portion of the fifth chapter? That we were alcoholic and our lives had become unmanageable. Two, we believed that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. Now, who said that? Was that some Jesuit priest from Santa Clara? Was that the Pope in the Vatican? Was that some guy up in Salt Lake City? No. Those words originated approximately 47 years ago in a room no bigger than this, with about as half as many people in it as there are in this one tonight. In that room were those 100 men and women who we refer to as the original members of our fellowship, sat down and courageously put into writing their experiences, their strengths, and their hopes to bring a book called Alcoholics Anonymous to its birth. In that group were believers. In that group were devout. In that group were atheists. And in that group were agnostics. But that entire group, in full accord, said in the next of those three facts, but God could, and they named him God, if he were sought. There's no room for argument there. And if that isn't the closest thing to a guarantee that you'll ever get in this program, then my name ain't Gene D. God could and would if he was sought. And I believe that. And I had to go out and search as you had to search because they told me that. If he was sought. I wasn't seeking now the child's God. I had known the child's God. Now I had to find a God that I could understand. And I found this God. And it was relatively easy because he walked daily amongst you. Everything that took place in your lives was an act of God. Things took place in not only your lives, but in my lives that had no other logical explanation than the fact that they were divinely guided by a God as I came to understand him. I found it hard, you know, to believe that a scum like me could walk once more in the presence of any kind of a God. Because as an alcoholic, practicing his illness, I was the farthest thing from God that you could find. I'm not proud of many of the things that were part of my drinking career. And I came here with a lot of shame, a lot of shame. But I heard a tale once that took away the shame, that gave me the courage, and most of all, allowed me to understand God. A tale that was told about a sharecropping family who lived down in Georgia. If you've ever been in Georgia, you know that's got to be tough. Trying to make a living out of the soil in Georgia. Now, this family had nothing, nothing. Things that we take so much for granted today were luxuries to them. But every year they just struggled through and they harvested and planted and just got by. Just got by. Always enough to buy the seed for the next year and enough to exist on for the rest of the year. And they never complained. And then one year, as it was wont to be, after all of the crops were in, the new seed was purchased, the money was spent and divided, they discovered they had $5 left over. And that was a great thing to this family, who had never really asked for too much. And so in family harmony, realizing that $5 wasn't enough that they could divide that would make any sense, they decided to buy a gift for the family, something that the entire family could share in. And so after some discussion, the family decided to buy a mirror. They had never owned a looking glass. No one in that family had ever seen his or her own true self. They all knew the beauty in each other, but no one had ever witnessed his own image. So it was an exciting day, the day that the mirror arrived. And they gathered in the kitchen, and they let the father, as the head of the family, be the first to look into the mirror. Now, he knew all of the beauty in his family, in his wife, and in his daughter, and in his little son. And when he looked into the mirror and saw himself for the first time, he did exactly what mature men would do. He sort of blushed a little, gave his nose a couple of whacks, pulled out the strap on his overall, you know, blushed and sort of smiled again and hung his head. He turned and he handed the mirror to his wife, who knew the beauty of her husband and of her children. And when she looked at herself for the first time, she too did what exactly elderly, mature women would do. She blushed and smiled and patted the back of her hair and fooled with the collar on her house coat and juggled with her specs a little bit. And blushed, smiled, hung her head low, and turned and handed the mirror to her beautiful, beautiful teenage daughter, who did exactly what beautiful teenage girls would do. She giggled and smiled and giggled and tee-heed and fooled with her curls and played with the ribbon in her hair and giggled a little bit more and blushed and turned red and hung her head and turned and handed the mirror to her little 7-year-old brother. Now, her little brother knew all of the beauty in his family. And when he had only been 1 year old, I guess, he had been standing alongside of his daddy while his daddy was milking the cow. And the cow had kicked out and struck this little boy right in the face. And what was supposed to have been a child's face was twisted, ugly, grotesque flesh. Horrible. And when that little child looked into the mirror and saw what was supposed to have been his face, he was confused and he was bewildered. And he didn't know what to do. And he turned to his mother and he said, "Mama, have I always been this ugly?" And she said, "Of course not." He said, "But Mother, how can you love me when I'm so ugly?" And she said, "Because you're mine." And that's the relationship that I have with God as I understand Him now. For He besides myself is the only other person who has known me in my total ugliness. When my family, with just cause, had to turn away from me because of my ugliness. When my friends also with just cause had to turn away because of my ugliness. I stood as you, with my back to the wall. And you said God could and would if He was sought. And I sought this God as directed by you, through prayer and through meditation. Now, I would never be that self-centered to believe that one day God came down and took me by His hand. But one day God, without any words of condemnation, without any damnation, selected one of you to be His instrument. And whoever He selected, He placed into their hands the basic message of recovery as outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And He sent that instrument to me. Thank you very much for having me.